Welcome to the Women and Wealth podcast with Esther Szabo. Esther is a respected leader in the field of personal financial advice with over 25 years of experience. After going through her own significant and challenging life-changing events, she overcame fear and self-doubt to launch her own successful advisory firm. Now Esther is ready to share her practical and personal experiences to help other women clear their hurdles and brave life's transitions. In this way, she inspires women to lead fulfilling and confident lives.
Hello and welcome to Women in Wealth with Esther Szabo from Gates Pass Advisors. Esther, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi there, Eric. I'm doing very well. How are you doing out there today?
I'm going to geek out at this podcast, but before that, I held off my comments because you asked me, how's the weather? And you were so nice. I just said, I don't want to talk about it. Then you told me how beautiful it was where you're at. So now I am going to complain just slightly. Tomorrow's going to be 107 with 140,000% humidity. So yay no, for
it's
us.
The humidity that's the thing. Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah. 107, that's not normal for here. Ever. So anyway,
it's time to get out the kiddie pool, Eric.
Yes. It's not a kiddie pool when I'm in it. It's just, it's like an inch of water because everything else is out. Anyway, we didn't come here to talk about my kiddie pool or the weather. You have a special guest, and that is David Mackman. I'm really excited to hear what he has to say. And David Mackman is of Mackman Law Group. David Mackman has been a technology lawyer since 1995. He does undergraduate work in computer science and Asian studies at Oberlin College and worked in international marketing before becoming a lawyer. He currently has his own firm where he litigates intellectual property cases and commercial cases involving technology and finance. He has been involved in Bitcoin, Ethereum, and blockchain technology since 2014. And in 2016, recognizing the importance of this technology, he obtained a FinTech certificate from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Holy cow. I told you I'm going to geek out. I'm really excited about this because I'm really into cryptocurrency. I don't own any. I'll just say that right up front, Esther, but I'm really curious. I think there's a lot of people in my boat.
It's really intriguing. We've heard about it for years. We know it's volatile, but we know it can be worth an awful lot of money. And we get questions about it. Is this a place to invest? David, thank you so much for joining us today here on the podcast. It's great to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I am very excited to hear what you have to say. And we're basically going to talk today about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and what the future is with these. So let's start with, what is cryptocurrency?
Yeah, it's always a little difficult to explain, but the underlying technology is called blockchain, and it is a distributed public ledger, and we can explain a little more about what that means. One of the things you can do with that technology is create digital tokens, which can be used as money. So digital currency is really tokens that are stored on this distributed public ledger that are being used as money. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's interesting because my brain goes, yes, that makes sense and that's very clear. And then the other thing is, how is it used as money?
And that's pretty difficult to answer because for whatever reason, it's really hard to know what money itself is, if that makes sense. Money is, I don't know, do you have a definition of money that you use?
It's a means for purchasing goods and services.
Okay. That's a good thing.
And being paid for one's own service. Yeah. So goods and services. It's right. a form that everyone recognizes and has an understanding about what the value is.
An understanding about what the value is.
Mm-hmm.
That's the rub with the cryptocurrency area. And some people feel that money in itself is able to store value. Others, and this is where I put it, is they only have value if people accept them as having value. They're like promises. And if you read books about anthropology and whatever, you'll find civilizations that use stones or feathers or things that have no underlying value as a currency. Mm-hmm. And so all you need to make a currency work is a number and everybody to agree to accept that number, and then it has value as long as people accept it. So the definition I use for money, and I hate to be too cerebral, but it's my nature, is the social, the numerical crystallization of the social contract. It's a number that can be used to create social contract. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
It does. It absolutely does.
And so the ledger just says how many tokens there are and who owns the tokens. The technology allows us to share data, share the information of how many tokens there are and who owns them, and makes it difficult to take other people's tokens away from them. If you're in that space, really, why the technology is exciting has very little to do with cryptocurrency. And cryptocurrency is, in my view, an application that makes it harder to understand the technology and doesn't really embody the best benefits of the technology.
Yeah, I know we've talked about it before. That bifurcation between the technology, the blockchain technology, and then cryptocurrency being an application of the technology. I appreciate that before we had talked before the podcast, that wasn't as clear in my mind at all. I thought they were one and the same. So that's really helpful to know in terms of clarification. But then as you say, the currency and where you were going in terms of, okay, so what's the value of this currency? Who's in charge of determining that?
Who's in charge of it? That has been left to market forces. I guess let's go back a little more into the technology. Let's say, so it turns out, at least if you think of information science, there is a great deal of value in information that is trusted, in information that you know is mm-hmm. correct. Mm-hmm. And in database technology, we call it persistence, the persistence of the data, or immutability, or that sort of concept. And so this technology allows shared data that is not owned or controlled by any one person to be shared and still to be trustworthy. That's what's exciting about the technology. They say it's a distributed ledger. That means lots of people have copies of the ledger. It's on the blockchain. Lots of people have copies of the blockchain. The blockchain is this big clump of data that's structured in blocks. So it's a chain of blocks that is data. And the information there is all shared. Everybody can see it equally. A lot of it's encrypted, and so you may see it and not understand it, but it's all shared, and everybody agrees as to the exact substance of every byte of that data, from the first byte to the last byte. You've got 800,000 or a million computers that have done the math to confirm that they all have the same data. They're all mm-hmm. looking at the same data. And so if you ask any of them what's at such and such a location, they'll all give you the same answer.
And that's one of the things that's really unique about this technology, right? That it is shared, that it's open, that it's validated mathematically.
Right. Mm-hmm. And with Bitcoin, which was the first application that really, or the first digital currency and blockchain that really was successful, with Bitcoin, the process of verifying the integrity of the data is done in return for a reward. You get a Bitcoin token, you get Bitcoin tokens for what they call it mining, but all you're really doing is running a computer that spends its time checking the quality of the data, mm-hmm. encoding the data so that you can verify the integrity. Do you know what a checksum is?
It sounds like something I should know. I'm going to say it's like something with accounting where you validate.
Yeah, it can be, but I may not have the exact right word either, but I've always thought of it. So Visa, for example, if you give Visa a number, it will know whether that number is a genuine Visa card number or not. Mm-hmm. They have a mathematical algorithm that they run on their numbers that tells them, you know, if a number doesn't meet that mathematical algorithm, they don't use it as a card number. Mm-hmm. And so you basically, you give it the number, you run it through the program, and it says, yes or no, this is a Visa number. That's all it tells you. That idea is expanded in the blockchain And that's how the data is verified. You run the computer, it sucks up all the data, it does some calculations on it, and it gets a result. And if the result matches, then it knows that the data is all correct. And if the result doesn't match, then it knows that something in the data has changed.
Got it.
And that math, if you're a computer programmer, is really interesting and exciting. And that's a lot of the reason that people in computer science spend a lot of time with this technology, is because the math, the related math in cryptography, is just fabulously interesting.
So what, I mean, in terms of cryptocurrency, this just today, El Salvador, it was noted in the news, El Salvador just adopted it as its legal tender alongside the US dollar. And what are your thoughts about that? Is cryptocurrency the future for currency globally?
I don't think so. So for me, I'm very excited about blockchain technology and about ways to collaborate and share and use data together. I'm not sure that it is a disruptive technology, or even that it has large value compared with the way that we have data stored right now. So I don't know that there's big money in this area. And if there is, I'm not sure that the money is tied to the cryptocurrency. What has happened is people issue these tokens. It's reliable. The scarcity of the tokens on the blockchain, that scarcity is guaranteed by the way things are set up. And you're allowed to trade them, and there are market makers. And so the market makers buy and sell at different prices and make money on the spread. They have a bunch of dollars, and they are willing to convert to buy Bitcoin at one price and sell it at another price and make money on the spread, as I said. And the price moves depending on supply and demand, so that the market maker is always able to make a profit. The market maker could use anything. Tulips is the famous example, right? Buying and selling mm-hmm. tulips in the Netherlands. Along the way, people made a lot of money, but there was not a lot of underlying value in the actual thing that was being traded. So where does money's value come from? First, we have to decide what it is and then where it comes from. Normally, it does come from the government, because you can pay taxes with your dollars. People need dollars to pay their taxes, and therefore there is some constant underlying demand for dollars. Because you can buy oil with dollars and not with most other currencies, there's a constant demand for dollars. And just because it's generally accepted, there's a demand. El Salvador, I don't think right now there is a lot of demand for promises from the El Salvadorian government. That's why they don't have their own currency, or one reason. And saying that they're going to accept digital currency, that's fine. I just don't think the technology is easy enough to use and reliable enough to be a serious contender for payment technology. I think your Visa card works way better than Bitcoin or even Ethereum or any of the other coins, with the exception of some coins that can be used to conceal your identity. I think it's harder to hide your identity using a Visa card than it is, but I'm not even sure that's true, than it would be with certain of the digital currencies.
Well, it was interesting because the story was also there about, for when there was the ransom of Colonial Pipeline, is what it was, and the money was recovered. It was in Bitcoin, and what's noted is one can stay anonymous all the way through until one goes to redeem the Bitcoin, and then it becomes visible. Is that true?
That sounds about right. So the reliability of the data is very high. The person, you don't know who put the data there or who took it from there. They have a key. They use public-private key technology, which, like you would see in PNP or all sorts of other encryption technologies. Mm-hmm. They have a key that says, I'm authorized to write to the ledger. And they use that key, and they can give somebody a public key so that person can read but not write. So that's the way that technology works. Once you associate the key with a person, then you can see everything they did using that key. Everything that key has ever been used for since the first creation of the blockchain it becomes available. And so you're anonymous until people figure out that it's your key. And then you're like completely the opposite of anonymous, like to a point where there's no privacy. So in litigation, for example, people try to get normal information about what the balances of a plaintiff or defendant are on the blockchain or who they're sending their money to. And the issue is, if you disclose the email that is associated with a particular key, you have a huge privacy issue for the person whose email, where that information has now been provided. That comes up in litigation from time to time, that information that would normally be, you just redact out the bank account and give them a copy of the bank statement, maybe redact out some information from in it, and then you've protected the privacy. It's much harder. You can't really redact things with the blockchain.
So that's one of the big areas of concern. Obviously, we're also concerned about privacy. So if this became a global currency, that would be a huge, that is already a huge issue, I would imagine. Who wants that all available around the world?
Right now, if the government knows my Visa number, they're going to know all my transactions anyway. But I can do things with paper money, and they're not traceable. That space doesn't exist with cryptocurrency unless the currency is specifically designed to hide the buyer and seller, which, and I feel there are some coins that were designed for that purpose. But Bitcoin and Ethereum are not that.
And if we switch a bit from the currency aspect to the investment aspect for the individual, because that's where there's a lot of interest also, I think you've already talked about what you shared about how somebody goes about getting Bitcoin in that example was by validating, verifying the data. But let's say somebody, you know, just wants to invest in Bitcoin. How do they do it? Or other cryptocurrency?
And that becomes an issue. You've got to find a business that is willing to exchange dollars for Bitcoin, or find somebody who's willing to give you some. And so I got some of mine when I had them, and I don't have any currently. I got some of mine by doing work for a client, and they paid me in the currency. When I did that, I quickly found out that it was very volatile. And so when I do a transaction, like a client will contact me on Monday, and I'll give them my quote for the work. I give them a quote in Bitcoin or dollars. We pick the currency at the outset of the quote. And by the time on an $800 project, it ranged from me getting paid $600 to $1,200, depending on how many days after the agreement was reached when I was in Bitcoin. And so that volatility is so high that on a one-week transaction, we had to negotiate about currency exchange risk. So Coinbase is a company, for example, that'll hook up to your bank account and you can buy digital currency from them. And then you can go to various exchanges and turn it into dollars and maintain balances there, or buy other currencies with it, or buy anything else that you might want to buy using digital currency instead of dollars.
And how, for publicly traded companies, there's a lot that goes into providing the value, or what would be the appropriate price and of the security, and it's based on earnings and earnings potential and lots of different factors. And you've touched on this too, that Bitcoin is regulated, quote unquote, primarily by everyone having access to the data and confirming it. Did I get that correct?
Not really. No, that the shared data. Sorry, I didn't mean to be. I didn't mean to be rude or anything. But
No,
everybody agrees about the contents of the blockchain. So who owns which coins is demonstrable and to a high degree of certainty.
Mm-hmm.
But
value,
that has nothing to do with regulation, right? Governments pass laws, and they think it's an interesting idea to have this technology, and they don't want to crush it by regulating it too much, or at least that's the way we work in America. And what kind of happens is various authorities sit around watching what happens and then making up the rules as they go along, and the SEC would be the main one, but there are other. The Treasury could look at it, the Federal Reserve could look at it, Congress could look at it, all the state legislatures could look at it. And for a lot of things that are being done in digital currency, that I'm seeing, people are advising just don't offer the currency in the United States because you don't want to deal with the U.S. regulatory organizations. And get into this international space. If you start looking at the currency, who's issued it and where was it issued and where were they formed as a corporation? A lot of them were in the Marshall Islands or the Turks and Caicos Islands. And it's fine to do business with a company in those locations, but if you ran into a problem and had to sue them in the Marshall Islands, what do you know about that legal system? Like on the international, I won't buy Chinese stocks because I don't think I actually, when I buy them, I own the stock. I think I own a contract with some company in Hong Kong that owns the stock. And that's so weird that I'm not comfortable with it. And I don't have, I broke that rule once and I got taken to the cleaners with a company called Luckin Coffee, which turned out to be making up all of its numbers. And I was like, that's why I should never have invested in China. But so you kind of got to look at what the underlying business is that supports the value. What do they claim the value of the digital currency is? Where do they think the value is coming from? Do you believe it? Will it generate revenues? All those sorts of things. And fundamentally, I love to speculate. This is an area for speculation. It's not an area for investment right now. Even though I believe very strongly in the technology.
Yeah, and I know you feel really excited about the technology, but not so much about, because of those issues that you just mentioned, about the current state of investing in the cryptocurrency itself, because it sounds like it's pretty Wild West. It's who do you know who's providing the price and where are they located? And if you had to go after them, could you? I know you've done a lot of work. You did a lot of work with the Mt. Gox bankruptcy. And can you talk a bit about that?
I've been following the bankruptcy. Mt. Gox is one of the first really successful digital currency exchanges. And they're based in Tokyo. And I do, you know, I have the East Asian studies background. I do a lot of Japan-related work. And they got hacked or had some problems with the way that they stored their digital currency and lost a bunch of it. Most of it was hacked, I think, and went bankrupt because they weren't able to give people the money that people had on deposit with them. And so when that happened, they had a big pile of bitcoins and some other digital currencies, and people who had money on deposit there were able to file claims with the Japanese bankruptcy court, and then periodically the bankruptcy trustee shows up and delivers a report about what he's doing to protect people's assets and to try and turn their claims into actual payouts. So I've been following it. I've been reading the reports as they come out. I don't have it strongly in my head right now, but fundamentally, you know, around the time of the bankruptcy, I think it was $800 per Bitcoin, and the bankrupt assets had some value that were all converted actually into yen, not into dollars. And now it's $50,000 per Bitcoin or whatever it is today. And so it's been an interesting bankruptcy in that the value of the assets has increased as the case has been pending. It's been very complicated because of the large number of claimants, because of the difficulty of the technology, because of communication issues, that the proceedings are all in Japanese. The trustee issues excellent English language reports, but it's still fairly opaque if you don't understand Japanese bankruptcy law, which is not well documented in English. And so it's just been long and slow. There were also international aspects. There were a number of lawsuits against Mt. Gox in the United States. And so those have moved slowly and have delayed the timing. And I don't know when the actual payouts are going to happen in that. But yeah.
And so again, another risk to just where it is right now in terms of investing. And as you said, this is the first successful exchange and they got hacked. And so that's the other piece.
Yeah, well, and so you get the money, right? You have an account with Coinbase. Maybe you move it into a wallet. It's common to you might say, I don't want to store it with this one company because that company has everybody's information. So if they get hacked, then they're a good target. I'm going to move it to my own little wallet. And then it'll be only me that knows about it, only me that knows how to get to it. then you immediately are going to get, what happened to me anyhow when I first got digital currency was I got phishing emails. People were trying to find my accounts and take the money. They never succeeded because I didn't, whatever. I got lucky anyhow. They don't seem to have stolen the stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's intimidating because your money is just sitting there out on the internet. And if anybody can find the right key, they can take it away. And you also have the problem that when you store it with a company, the company can get hacked and things can get stolen. There have been several hacks. Bitfinex is an exchange out of Hong Kong that got a $50 million hack. They didn't go bankrupt. They actually issued tokens against their future profits. So if you had money with them, they were like, I can't pay you today, but sign this contract and I'll issue these tokens to you. And over time, those will be worth money and you'll get your money back. And so nobody sued them. People just accepted that. And they dug their way out of that bankruptcy, I think, or not bankruptcy, out of that hack. I think they got hacked again. I don't know what happened the second time. But clearly, if people are getting hacked for $50, $100 million at a pop, the companies that are the foundation of this, of the currency, it's not ready for prime time.
Mm-hmm. And as such, as we're wrapping up, I would say from your perspective, would you recommend cryptocurrency as any part of a person's investment portfolio? Even a young person who's really excited that this will be the next wave of digital transformation in the world?
I don't think of it as an investment. I think of it as a speculation.
Mm-hmm.
An investment, you have some reasonable understanding of what the returns are going to be and what the risk is about whether you will get them or not. Like with a bond, I put $10,000 in, I get 5% interest. I know when the bond ends, I know exactly how much money I'm going to make unless the company falls apart. With this, you have no idea where it's going to be in a year. And so then it's a game. And while it goes up, it's wonderful. Fed today just said they're thinking about raising interest rates, I think. That should have a negative effect on a lot of the wilder things that are happening in the market for cryptocurrency. But no,
that's
I
exciting.
Wouldn't recommend it as an investment.
It's exciting, yeah, David. Well, it could get you to your goals so much quicker than the boring old stock market.
So go for it. And in that sense, if you compare it to Vegas, where the odds are definitely set against you, maybe it's a better bet than the roulette wheel.
And with that,
right?
We'll leave it there.
Okay.
No, it's true. We fall very much in the same speculation camp because it is so incredibly volatile. And Elon Musk tweets something and it drops by, 40%. It could be interesting, but in terms of your investment assets and what you're relying on for your future, your kids' college education, your retirement, your ability to leave work at age 50 rather than older or even younger than 50, it's not the foundation to rely on for that. David, thank you so much for all this information that you've shared so clearly. If people want to reach out to you to talk about your understanding here in this area or anything else around patent and intellectual property, how do they reach you?
My email is david@macmanlaw.com. That's probably the best way to reach me.
Okay. So david@macmanlaw.com.
David@macmanlaw.com.
Okay. david@macmanlaw.com. And
yeah, we're small enough. I only do first name.
Okay. Thank you so much, David. It's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you.
David, this has been fantastic. Thank you for being here. Like Esther said, Esther, thank you so much for bringing him on. I have pretty much resigned myself and figured out that the cryptocurrency game is, for me, going to be very much like an NFL game. Way too risky for me to get in the game at this point in my age, in my life. I'm too old to get and play in the NFL. There's too much risk. And so I think that's going to be the same thing for me with cryptocurrency. I'll watch from the sidelines and see what people do and let them speculate. But I don't want to get in the game because I know I'm going to just get trampled. So I think I'll stay out. Again, Esther, thank you so much for bringing David on. And our last thank you always goes to you, the listening audience. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the Women in Wealth podcast with Esther Szabo. If you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This way, when Esther comes out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. This makes it much easier to share these podcasts with your friends and family. Again, thank you so much for listening today. For everyone at Gates Pass Advisors, this is Eric Johnson reminding you to live your best day every day. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Women and Wealth Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you receive notifications of new podcasts as they become available. Check out the website at www.gatespassadvisors.com for more information. This content is developed from sources believed to be providing accurate information. The information in this material is not intended as tax or legal advice. Please consult legal or tax professionals for specific information regarding your individual situation. The opinions expressed and material provided are for general information and should not be considered a solicitation for the purchase or sale of any security.